I'm Pierre Daly.
And I'm Mike Philbrick.
And this is Raise Your Average.
We've got a humdinger of a guest on today.
I know. You know, I've caught them on different conferences where the round table that they were in was recorded. And they're just both, you know, really fascinating people from the field because they've chosen to sort of, you know, really specialize in this particular sphere of options and the options market. And I think they've got a lot to offer in terms of what's going on in this new sort of market that we're in, where a lot of investors are opting for paycheck type investment options versus total return. And I had a great conversation with Jillian Del Signore from NASDAQ Indexes. She does a lot of work with advisors on this particular subject. And so she had two views on it. She, you know, she talked about how there's this wave of income strategies washing over the wealth management industry right now. A lot of advisors, you know, have come to this conclusion that, you know, when you're building portfolios for investors who are either wanting yield, just for the simple reason of being able to reinvest it, or they're in the decumulation phase of their life and they need to take income from their investments, or they want, you know, retirement income, they want to supplement their income from their investments. One sort of great point that she made was that you can't eat total return, right? So a lot of investors are opting for, you know, these so-called paycheck options where you're getting a payment every month, either that's from covered calls, cash secured puts, whatever the strategy is. Buy right strategies are very popular. Buffered ETFs have also become very popular, not necessarily as a paycheck option, but as a defined outcome. And so investors have sort of become weary of the risk, but they also want the assurance of getting a payment every month from their investments, which they can either take and spend or they can put back into their portfolio and reinvest. There's a lot of this going on, right?
Yeah. And I think most investors, you know, assume they understand what they own. They assume that they understand the payoff vectors of the put writing or the call writing that they're doing. And the interesting thing is when you get into some of these products, really kind of get in the nuts and bolts, and let's say they have sort of a monthly rebalance. Well, that product actually changes quite significantly based on the what's called the moneyness of the options being sold. How deep in the money are they? How deep did they start? So if you started where everything was written and you were harvesting volatility, because that's what this is, when you're operating in the call and put market and you're a seller, you're harvesting that volatility, but you have some return output that comes on the other end, and it changes dramatically based on the price changes. And if you're not managing that portfolio more rapidly than, let's say, monthly, the payout changes dramatically. So you think you're buying one thing, but you're actually getting a very different exposure. And so our guests today are going to, you know, really kind of dig into this and push back hard on some of the assumptions that people have. And I think we're really lucky to have Zed Francis and Devin Anderson, who built Convexitas around this, you know, sort of very simple but uncomfortable idea that, you know, the options market is structurally mispriced, and most of these yield-seeking investors that you're talking about kind of on the wrong side of it. And so we want to really make sure that we can dig into this and help both investors and advisors look at these products in a new light to understand exactly what they're getting, because there is a great opportunity in harvesting some volatility for a portfolio, for a portion of that portfolio. Sizing is important, but also understanding what you're getting when you're buying these types of products is very important.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Stay tuned. I know our audience is going to get a lot out of this conversation. Clearly, there's a reason why these two gentlemen decided to specialize in this area.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Gentlemen, Devin, Zed, welcome to Raise Your Average. It is terrific to have you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Really looking forward to our conversation. You know, there's so much happening in the derivative income space, particularly in areas like covered calls, buffered ETFs, put writing strategies. And there's so much more complexity than meets the eye for investors and advisors alike to understand. I wonder, you know, first of all, where are you guys joining us from?
The firm's headquartered in Chicago. Zed's in Chicago. I'm currently in Southern Connecticut. I used to have a commute to the city. I don't anymore, so I split my time between Chicago and New York, Southern Connecticut area.
You got these hard tell. It's a nice 80 degrees and sunny in Chicago, so we take advantage of those days when they happen in the spring.
I was going to ask at first. I thought maybe you were in Florida or something or down south. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Devin Anderson and Zed Francis from Convexitas are here. We are excited to have you. And I wonder, before we get started, if you could tell us a little bit about the arcs of your careers, you know, where you've been, where you started, and ultimately what precipitated or what triggered you to launch Convexitas?
Sure. I guess I'll go first. I have almost 20 years of experience in derivative markets. I joined Deutsche Bank out of a graduate program in 2005. And where I had kind of a lot of different jobs, from derivative salesperson to the structuring desk to eventually head of complex sales and the structuring business itself, in the equity derivatives platform. So, you know, I've kind of touched all the different parts of the derivatives, equity derivatives structuring world, from from structured products to fund derivatives to, we had a platform of managed accounts and SMAs called DB Select, and then just the flow and light exotics and QIS businesses as well. So I have a really deep background in not only kind of derivative risk, you know, as a quant, but also putting these things together into products. And before that, I had a philosophy that really go all the way back to the beginning of the internet. I helped start some internet service providers all the way back in 1996, and I worked in some data center businesses, kind of all in the pre-AWS cloud computing time. So I had a whole career in technology before I did this as well. And that kind of plays into what we do at Convexitas, in that in order for us to run some of our businesses, we've had to create some pretty interesting and unique technology to be able to scale derivative management, active derivative management, in the way that we needed it. So we had to create a lot of our own tools, and all this stuff ultimately came together to found Convexitas. I'll let Zed talk about his own career and what ended up bringing us together to start this 5 years ago.
Yeah, so I actually started at UBS's credit sales trading desk. And the only reason you bring it up is because my brain is a little bit wired to fixed income. So I may spend the vast majority of my career in volatility space, but have a little bit of that root in terms of how I think about stuff with the fixed income space, and specifically credit. And even though it was there a very short time, I had a very wonderful mentor that told me that I had to get the heck out of there before everything blew up. And I luckily escaped summer 2008 to a long short distressed hedge fund, which was a spectacular seat to be in, both into the GFC and then even better out of the GFC, to actually go through that whole restructuring process of so much of the economy, and moved on from the hedge fund world to start focusing on how can I bring all those skills to more of the asset management universe. And my first iteration of that was at Legal & General, the UK asset manager and insurer, where I was helping build out derivative overlay businesses for the institutional channel. But ultimately, everything that, you know, how I think about bringing derivatives to any sort of user is they're trying to increase flexibility, try to allow for opportunity when other things are a little more chaotic. And I just found that end investor of the institutional space to not be a good pair. When there was something to do that needed action, it was, oh, we'll get it on the docket for, you know, a committee meeting one or two quarters out in the future. That's not how I thought about building those businesses out, and was basically the wrong end user. And so moved over to the wealth channel, got a little experience with a firm out there that was doing derivatives and wealth, and said, you know what, I think I've you know, figured out my path through this whole iteration. Let's go ahead and build my own business with a great partner rather than keep on trying to build stuff for somebody else. So Devin and I, in 2020, when you started the podcast, when everybody was doing new things, right? We founded Convexitas, spent the first year and a half building out the technology. Well, Devin building out the technology, we whiteboarding things to try to help the best I could and getting onboarded to all the standard US retail custodians and started running external money in late 2021. But been, you know, the wandering path experience to kind of get us to where we are today, and really excited to help bring really interesting value add derivative strategies that increase flexibility rather than, you know, potentially get you in a hole during times of crisis to the wealth channel.
You know, I have to say, I find your career backgrounds astonishing. And, you know, it just serves as, to me, because I'm no mathematician, I'm no engineer, but what it helps me realize just sort of at the outset of our conversation is that there is so much more complexity than advisors and investors realize out in the wild. Like, you know, that sort of underlies what we're going to talk about today. I think, you know, most investors believe or think that they understand what they own when they're in a covered call ETF or a buffered product. And this isn't, you know, sort of, this isn't going to be a conversation, by the way, before we do get started. It's not going to be a conversation about taking these things apart. It's really a conversation about, you know, with a goal to understanding what these products actually consist of, how they work or how they don't work. It's really sort of an, you know, like to get into more of another model of a mental model of thinking about these things when you're going about allocating to them or investing in them. So that I just want to preamble, you know, our conversation. You know, we're not out to get the covered call business. We're out to sort of supplement the knowledge out there about that so that advisors can make better decisions. So, Zed, Devin, walk us through what they're actually holding, specifically, you know, things like real-time risk exposures. What do those real-time risk exposures look like as markets move versus what the, you know, the standard sort of hockey stick diagrams that expiry suggest?
Yeah, so I kind of just want to extend your sentiment there for a minute, and I'll let Zed talk about the risk aspects. There's nothing wrong, before we even get started, there's nothing wrong with these products. It's just, you know, this is a big part of why we started Convexitas. You can do a lot more with derivative risk than is currently available in the wealth world. This is why we started this whole business, right? You can improve the outcomes, in a lot of different ways. But it is going to inject a little bit of sophistication and, in our opinion, does require professional management. But that's not any different than any other product, financial product right. That you buy, right? Somewhere along the way, we got this idea in wealth that, you know, I'm going to draw some hockey stick diagrams on a piece of paper and quote, now you understand it. And actually, I think part of what we want to talk about is that hand waving over that simplicity is actually disguising a significant amount of risk. Again, it doesn't mean the products are bad. It just means that you can actually improve on those things with right. active professional management. And the thing that you need to really understand is how it fits in your portfolio and how you should expect it to behave. You actually don't need to understand down to the individual positions and when the manager is rolling his way. Now, you know, like, look, we're an open book. You know, in our SMA business, clients see the positions. In our ETF business, the clients see the positions. Like, you know, we talk about these things very openly, but the starting point is not the hockey sticks, right? The starting point is, how does this fit and what does it do for me at the portfolio level? And then we kind of can go down in the detail from there. So as Zed, you know, I'll let you kick off with the, you know, hidden complexity in the seemingly simple overwrite fund.
Devin, before you kick off, I would just add that, you know, you very nicely said that it masks you know, the risks, but it's also masking the wider field of opportunity that's available as well.
Yes, that's why. Again, that's why we started this business. It's why we have the SMA business. It's why we got involved with Quantify Chaos on these ETFs, because they were interesting enough to do. Like, yeah, there's so much more. If you compare, you know, Zen and I came from institutional backgrounds. If you compare how people use derivatives in an institutional setting to what was available to wealth, you know, we just think there's this huge green field to take what we would call like first generation derivative product and bring some of the sophistication from wealth, you know, in a wrapper that is digestible and usable for financial advisors, of course.
So I guess let's start, you know, where do these things tend to fit, as Devin alluded to? Well, you know, I think most cover call products are fitting in the lower risk than equities, probably marginally higher risk than fixed income, but the purpose of them is to be that kind of medium risk allocation that create distributions within the portfolio, right? So that's probably where most people think about where do these get placed within your portfolio. And, you know, just super simple. Okay, you have an S&P 500 cover call product that's selling at the money weekly calls. Okay, so if you invest $100 into that product, well, your risk right at the start, right when they, you know, buy S&P and sell that at the money call, is $50. You know, it's cutting the risk of that allocation in half, $100 of $50 of exposure. But if the market were to go up 1%, that $50 of exposure is probably down to $10, $15, $20. If the market was to go down 1%, that $50 exposure is probably up to $75, $80, $85. And if you're investing in something day one that says, I'm going to invest $100 and I expect it to have $50 of exposure, and it doesn't reset to the $50 of exposure until in this hypothetical day five at the end of the week where you do it all again, but then what you actually own any given day is probably decently different than what you actually thought you were investing in. Now, the argument of these folks that are operating these, you know, vanilla cover call strategies, like, hey, we're buying S&P, on Friday, we sell next Friday, it expires, we sell next Friday again, is if you were to do this, you know, 100,000 times, the average experience is going to be the same as if you risk managed it every single day, or if every single day you got it back to $50 in exposure. And that's pretty much the truth, right? Hey, if you did, you know, enough iterations, the random walk says your average experience is exactly the same. But if your intent was to invest in something that is a little bit lower risk than, you know, being long equities, to create distributions and have that kind of anchor in the back of your mind that I have $50 of risk per $100 invested, it's not necessary to be exposed to that random walk. Yes, if you lived 100,000 years or 100,000 weeks, the experience and its collective is probably the same of actually risk managing from a day-to-day perspective. But it is, in our opinion, that's unnecessary. We can go ahead and in these, you know, ETF wrappers, go ahead and make your experience $50 at close every single day. Like, we're rebalancing, you know, intra-period as well. But the main point here is it's an unnecessary, you know, risk within your portfolio to not know your exposure at all points in time, to have a very flat distribution of some weeks are really good, some weeks are really bad, where you can go ahead and centralize those average returns to something that's more consistent and expected. So if we're getting into, like, you know, anything where we think you have edge or anything along those lines, just blocking and tackling from a risk perspective, it's just there's a simpler way to actually deliver a more consistent return profile from what your expectations are day one, rather than being exposed to that random walk.
Where does the gap between perceived risk and actual risk tend to be the largest? And how would an advisor even know if their client's portfolio has quietly become a short vol portfolio across multiple products at once?
So there's a couple different questions there. The first is, some of the issuers actually do publish what the risk is on their website, right? So here's the fundamental problem. If on the day I initiate the product, I buy $100 worth of exposure, I sell some call that has a a 50 delta, and now I only have $50 of exposure. What I have in terms of just direct market exposure in a week, right, is going to depend on where the market goes, right? But sadly, the investors tend not to think about it. The advisor tends not to think about it that way. They think I have $100 of market exposure and then this thing making income, right? And they kind of failed to discount the fact that the thing making the income is a contingent obligation that has also created a short exposure, right? And that short exposure is convex as time passes and as the market moves around. So to the extent that, to answer your second question then, to the extent that the market goes up, right, even though you've done nothing, you've actually now got this short convexity in your portfolio that is kind of hidden, right? Unless you're really on top of what the underlying positions of the ETF are. Even if you are aware of, you know, but my market exposure fell from 50 cents on the dollar to 35 cents on the dollar as the market went up. What people generally are like, we've never found an advisor thinking about is the fact that now when the market goes down after the market has gone up 1-2 weeks out, now what has happened is as the market falls from that point, you're getting longer the market as it's falling. That's negative convexity, right? And that's the part that people don't quite get their heads around. And it's less of an issue in these overwriting products. It's much more of an issue in hedged equity style products where people think they're buying the market plus protection, right? And that hedged equity product includes a short call in it, which is fundamentally the same thing as the overwrite, right? And then the path of the market is market goes up, okay? So this short call that's in their collar has been essentially gaining risk and it's created now a short convexity. And then the market sells off 5 or 6%. And the performance of these hedged equity products looks exactly like the performance of a 60-40 portfolio or, you know, experiences like 80% of the downside of a 60-40 portfolio. And everyone goes, well, I don't understand what happened. Well, what happened is there's this negative convexity in the portfolio from these short calls. Now, like, it's very possible that people can use these products and fully understand this. And if you can honestly buy these products and just put it in a drawer for the life of the outcome period and not care what happens to them on a mark-to-market basis, then maybe this whole conversation is irrelevant to you. But the fact of the matter is that most advisors we speak to are accountable to their clients for performance explanations and performance attribution,
right,
on, you know, a quarterly or at least a once a year basis. So, we tend to hear a fair amount of frustration about, well, I own these things and sometimes they do things I don't understand, right? Well, it's kind of all about, you know, the fact that there's day one risk and then those risks evolve in a convex way as time passes, right? And as the market moves and, you know, kind of the advisor's expectation isn't updating along with the risk, right? So there's two answers to that. Either you put, you know, you have a bucket of your portfolio where you know this is possible. So it literally goes in a drawer and you don't look at it except for once a year. Okay. So that's a legitimate possibility for some people. The other is, you know, you look at products like the things that we manage that are actively managed to maintain a more constant risk profile, right? So that, you know, in our products, we're not, you know, well, at least in, this isn't about the ETFs, but, you know, in our SMA products, for example, that are meant to be protective strategies, you know, they're designed in such a way that they can't ever develop this sort of short convexity, right? So that's where the biggest gap is. It's kind of level one is not really knowing the fact that I bought this thing and it's not really giving me 100 cents of exposure, or it's not even giving me 50 cents of exposure. It's giving me whatever's happened to the market. And then the second layer is the rate at which that exposure changes is often, they often have either no expectation for that or it's an incorrect expectation.
Right. It really is a function of building that intuition, right? There's this simple covered right illustration point in time. But as soon as you look at that, price changes and it changes the outcome of that particular setup. And that's the intuition that's lacking. And I don't think that many investors kind of have internalized that, you know, you're selling at the money call, you're at that 50 delta. And all that means for those out there listening is you've got 50% exposure to the underlying market that you've sold against. But then, as the gentleman pointed out, it goes up a little bit. Okay, now it's, you know, you've encountered some of those gains, but that call option now has a larger impact on the underlying position than it did previously. Subsequent investor comes in on the next day and they have a different exposure than they expected rather than the same exposure. And then you think about that through rebalancing timelines. Okay, so maybe I want to rebalance this. Well, what am I rebalancing and how is that different? How does that change things versus if I were actively managing it and could count on that particular delta setup on an ongoing basis? And do you guys typically target a delta area? Is it 50? Is it 30? Is it 70? Or does that depend on the product and depend on the outlook of the investor? How do you guys think through that?
Well, we actually don't run any straight covered call strategies. So I don't want to comment on a strategy that doesn't exist, but you know, I can give you the example of the income stack products, right? Where, you know, those are unique in that the goal of those is to provide 100% exposure to two different things, in each fund, right? So every dollar that goes in the fund, in the case of ISBG, it's intended to deliver a dollar of exposure to gold and a dollar of exposure to IBIT, the Bitcoin ETF. So in those cases, what we're managing to is maintaining that at 100% each all the time and constructing that in such a way that we can collect some option decay along the way. So that's where the income is coming from. It's coming from the actual way we construct the two long market positions. So that's kind of a much different way of thinking about both return stacking and income kind of in concert at the same time. Those funds, these income stack funds are meant to have, you know, 200% gross exposure, 100% to two different assets, right? And do it in such a way that you get to collect some option decay along the way, right? Now, at times we will be short calls in those products and times we won't. It just depends on the relative value of what we think the best way to construct that net long market position is. But, you know, the primary risk of those things is that. So that's the target we're managing to. But importantly, we're attempting to maintain 100%. You know, by prospectus, it's actually a band because you can't maintain it perfectly at 100. These things are convex and any change as the market moves around. But, you know, we're managing to this target window, all the time. So that's much different than saying, I'm going to do some trades on T and then hands off until everything expires. Then I'm going to do it again. Right. We are, you know, daily or multiple times a day, if necessary, making risk adjustments to try to making sure we're staying on those exposure targets. So that's the kind of an example I like to focus on just because those are the relevant products that we actually are managing.
So when you look across the covered call space, the sort of general space of covered call ETFs, do you see this kind of option drift? That we're talking about where you know, you start out with a position and then it drifts into negative convexity. Is that a common problem that's occurring across?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, markets go up more than they go down. So it's the predominant risk actually. Right. I mean, I'm telling you, if I go to Future Proof, okay. And I do 30 one-on-one meetings of Future Proof with advisors, which we do once or twice a year. I would say out of 30, 12 to 15 times I have the conversation, my outcome or cover call product did not behave as I expected. I mean, it's that prevalent.
And I mean, the problem is that I think the problem historically is that the covered call ETF strategy, first of all, took a long time. They have a very long runway and it took a long time for investors and advisors alike, advisors first to warm up to it and understand it. And secondly, then to start talking to their clients about it and explain it and then have their clients understand it. But, you know, it's sort of a case of simple, but not easy, right?
That's a nice thing. Yeah. I think that's a very good way to put it. Yeah.
Or simple, but not too simple.
Right? Yeah. Straightforward, but yeah. Not simple. Yeah.
Yeah. the problem is, you know, sort of time, being time constrained is a big problem, right? This is what you guys do 24/7, but advisors and investors don't necessarily have the time to get into the sort of nuts and bolts of what we're talking about right now. So
I think a fair amount of it also comes from a misunderstanding of what selling options fundamentally is, right? So, you know, you sell an option, you get some money, right? Well, that's not like, yeah, you get to keep that premium, but that's not what a professional option trader would call P&L, right? The P&L, because you've sold this option, you now have a contingent obligation that you don't know what it's going to be worth at expiry. Until it expires wherever, you don't know what it's going to be worth, right? So just because I sold an option doesn't make that premium gains. What are gains at any point in time is the difference between the price that you sold it for and what it's worth today. And that will continue to update every moment of every day, well, that the market is open, between the day you sold it and the day it expires, right? So that's why, like, when I talk about the how we construct the income stack products, it's why I describe it this way, right? Like, we have a series of trades, some long options and some short options, that are going to maintain our 100% exposure to each of the two assets in the fund. But we've done it in such a way that we're going to collect a little decay every day, right? But it's not as if every time we sell an option, we say, oh, well, I got 50 cents per contract to that. Like, you know, put that in the bank. That's P&L. No, right? I mean, if I sold an option for 50 cents on T and it closes because whatever, the market moved against it just enough that it's worth 50 cents at the end of the day that I closed it, the P&L is zero. Not 50 cents, right? And the notion that there's this contingent obligation that has to be closed before it's P&L, I think that there's a little bit of a short circuit around that, because there's a lot of people out there selling short option products as if they were bond-like replacements, okay? And it's a dangerous comparison, right? Because when I buy some sort of fixed income, and if I just hold that fixed income to maturity in the absence of default, I know exactly what my return is going to be, right? I know that it's going to be worth par at the end, right? I don't know that when I sell options,
right?
It's an open-ended obligation. So to treat it like a duration asset, right? I mean, even, you know, people, like, if you want to make a comparison, it's not like short options have a duration of 20, okay, which would be a lot of duration risk for the average person. Yeah, it's probably more like 50, right? If we really wanted to, like, do some simulations and figure out a comparable difference, right? 40 to 50, probably. So, you know, I think these short option strategies probably have, if we wanted to talk about it in duration terms, twice or more of the risk of a fixed income like replacement, even though that's the way people like to talk about them. And it's not, again, like, as long as you qualify these things and you understand the comparison that you're making, it's not wrong. But I don't often hear that. I think that there's a lot of, well, I sold this thing and I got my mailbox money and now I get to keep that. And it's like, well, maybe, right? It depends on what happens between now and expiration. And then that kind of cascades along into this entire thing of dynamic risk and so forth. So that's where, you know, it's kind of, there's multiple layers of I would say incomplete understanding.
So why don't we compare and contrast that with a concept of how you would approach the problem, given what you guys know? We've had, you know, certainly a massive explosion of covered writing products, more the simple ones. So there's two things that I think of. How has that impacted the market? Are we seeing, you know, those call prices mispriced or underpriced because there's so much selling? Is there an opportunity in that? Is that what you're watching for? And how would you construct that portfolio vis-a-vis, let's say, the simple covered call situation? How does Convexitas approach that? And what are the advantages to that?
Yeah, so in index options, volatility risk premia has still remained reasonably persistent. And in fact, ever since you know, kind of tariff tantrum last year. It's been pretty strong. So what does that mean? That means the implied volatility, the volatility baked into the options you can either buy or sell, has been higher than realized volatility, how much the underlying market has been moving. So, you know, it's a multi-decade long thing that there is a risk premium built into index options. There's a lot of productization that helps drive that. Yes, there's been an increase in overriding programs, but it's been, you know, still reasonably persistent. In fact, the last year has been pretty darn strong after the big pullback, you know, a little over a year ago now. But the big difference in construction, as you say, most of the, you know, products out there in the overriding space versus how we think about it, is I'll try to make it a tangible example. So say, you know, every single day you're receiving a dollar for selling away upside. Okay. The standard kind of overriding program is market down, market flat, I receive that dollar. Market up, I'm receiving less than a dollar and could be a pretty big negative number if it's up a lot. And you're just doing that every single day. Like the range of outcomes is pretty long, wide. You know, at the end of the day, let's say if you average them all out, you're making 20 cents a day. All right. There's still volatility risk premium. You're still receiving some value, but in the just kind of random walk, you know, some days are a dollar, some days are negative a lot, but hey, it averages out to 20 cents. All we're saying is what you should be doing is you receive that dollar, but you should be spending some of that dollar every single day to defend your risk position. And what that means in our universe is just get yourself back to that targeted risk, you know, throughout the day. And our outcome is saying, we think at the end of the day, we're receiving a dollar, we're spending 80 cents every single day to defend our risk position. And so we're getting to that similar, if not the same, 20 cents of capturing value from volatility risk premium, i.e. options being too expensive versus what's actually happening on any given day. It's just our path is trying to be pretty darn consistent. We're just getting back to that same target exposure, trying to capture that spread, deliver that edge that's in these options generically in index space of being too expensive in a consistent pattern rather than, you know, something that has a big distribution. So that's saying, you know, again, We're saying we have no specific edge in this, but there is a structural edge that options are too expensive. And so we're being risk managers choosing to extract that structural edge in something that's more consistent rather than a, you know, pretty wide random walk. So that's, you know, hopefully a little bit of a digesting, you know, what we're doing. Like we still believe that index options are too expensive relative to what they should be. So there is a little bit of value. But how we're trying to create the value is more persistent from a risk management perspective of having that delivery on any given day versus a wide swath. And maybe it averages out, you know, to be the same if you have enough iterations. But we just think that's an unnecessary choice. You'd much rather have more consistent distribution of that edge rather than something that's a little more random walk with some pretty big tails.
Right.
So you're smoothing that line, basically.
That's a lot of the goal.
Yeah.
Have that distribution be, you know, steep in the middle versus really wide.
Yeah.
But yeah,
you know, trying to reduce the amount of luck that you might experience in particular the bad luck. Right. If you go into one of these products and you have the negative outcome very early, then that negative drag is going to persist through the entire return stream. Whereas if you're doing it on a intraday basis, you're going to get a much more consistent and persistent harvesting of that without the opportunity for bad luck to undermine that strategy's returns to your portfolio. Is that a fair way to say it?
I think you're maybe being a little generous when you say luck. I think I'd say it more directly, which is the risk of the product ought to be determined by the manager, not the random path of the market, right? If I set out to say this is the profile I'm trying to target with this derivative portfolio, the manager, in our view, right? The you know, there's a reason that we waited a long time to get involved in the ETF space. the risk ought to be controlled by the manager, not overwhelmingly determined by the passage of time and where the market goes. And, you know, that's kind of our primary complaint with a lot of the traditional covered call space, and why, you know, we went kind of years of looking at possible ETF iterations and working with different issuers before we chose to, you know, start with Quantify Chaos on these income stack products.
Yeah. And is this sort of the reason you guys sort of define a financial product versus an investment product as being different in evaluating these strategies? Is that the core behind that? Or is that something a little different?
That's Zed's determination or differentiation. I mean, I like it, but I'll let him talk about it.
Ultimately, an investment product should be, first off, trying to deliver something that you can buy and hold, right? And a financial product is more likely to be, you know, we'll call it a trading instrument, right? You have a view for a specific time frame, something along those lines. And we're really focused on creating things that are a real investment product, something that you can allocate to. You can allocate to it because you understand what it's trying to deliver, you know, throughout time. And ultimately, it's not something that needs to be traded because the manager is doing their job trying to deliver that known risk and trying to create that ability to have long-term compounding with that known risk. So, you know, that's my quick, you know, iteration is, you know, something that's truly an allocation within a portfolio with a design purpose that you brought it into the portfolio versus something that is more of a trading tool or like that.
I got you. So rather than contrasting like a position, you think, you know, yields are going to rise and you want to put on some sort of derivative structure that is targeted that investment outcome that you're trying to capitalize on. And so you're going to use some options to create an exposure that fits in the portfolio, knowing that that particular opportunity has a timeline to it versus ongoingly.
If you were picking like a random overwriting single name product or a levered ETF that all it is, you know, 200 cents a SPY every single day, like those kind of all tend to fall into trading instruments. Like you have a view that you're using this tool to then express that view. And what we're trying to say is, you know, we're trying to build something that's very robust that you understand day one what it holds. And guess what? Day 1000, it's still going to have that same style of risk. And we want to make sure that as it goes from day one to day 1000, that path is generally leading to long-term compounding benefits rather than issues with, you know, trading style instruments that might have those, you know, hiccups along that path that disrupt that long-term and compounding opportunity.
Right. Which is to say, investment products, advisors know how to allocate client dollars to investment products, right? They can choose from a menu that says, this is what I expect this thing to do, right? And this is how it fits into my portfolio, right? You know, in the income stack case, this client wants exposure to gold. They want exposure to Bitcoin. I can do it in a very capital efficient way in this product. It's going to give me, you know, within this range, but in expectation, 100 cents on the dollar to both. And hopefully I'm going to pick up some income along the way as well, right? Like that's a rational allocation, right? You know, to Zed, you know, to use Zed's taxonomy, trading products, you don't really allocate to, like you don't, you know, you might have a tactical view, but you don't really have an expectation of what the thing is going to do, right? Because the distribution of the future is very wide. Right. Yep. Because you're, you know, particularly in these covered call products, like, you know, like I say, you're selling these options and, you don't know what they're going to be worth at the end. And you're not rebalancing them, right? On any one path of the market, whether one path is one day, one week, or one month. So it's just like a whole different orientation, right? Like we're trying to use derivatives to build very interesting investable products that are useful to advisors. Right. Not to say that trading vehicles aren't useful, right? It just different purpose, right? In a different corner of your portfolio.
Exactly. What's the objective function of what you're trying to put in the portfolio? making sure that it meets that objective function? Is it a long-term investment allocation where I want these two asset classes and I'd like to harvest some volatility return from that? Great. Or is it a specific thing you're trying to do? You want to put a short position on to hedge something you have because you're pregnant, capital gain, or those types of things where they're much more oriented towards a short-term decisive time frame and a specific view.
All right. So then, and I might be jumping the question list here, but then you get into this question of, okay, if I want to own gold and Bitcoin, like what's the way to do it? Right. Is there, can I improve on just buying IBIT and GLD? Can I improve on that? Can I do better? Right. And we think that because of the edges that we've identified in the options prices, themselves, we're not making a statement about the direction of either gold or IBIT. Due to the edge that is identifiable in the option prices themselves, we can construct that exposure with this option portfolio with more interesting return, income, and tax characteristics than you would do from buying the ETF. So this is kind of, when we're talking about should I use these products, I think the first hurdle you have to get over is, can I improve on just owning very basic cash ETFs, right? That's step number one. Can I do better? Right. So obviously we manage these products and we said yes to quantified chaos. We believe that you can improve on them. And we believe that the source of that improvement is, real identifiable edge and biases that occur in option prices, right? And we can lean on those biases to deliver that risk in an interesting way. Right. So that's what, if I was still running a structuring desk, that's what I would call good structuring, right? Like we've improved on some on a cash allocation due to the characteristics of the options themselves, right? Anybody can draw hockey sticks and tell you how options will pay out. But actually trading options is far more than just simply understanding what they pay out at expiry, right? The business of trading options, or the professional business of trading options, is about understanding flows and biases and then being able to be on the correct side of those such that you can improve on just allocating to a cash vehicle.
I think, I think investors have been given this opportunity to invest in defined outcomes, right? You buy a covered call ETF, it has a target yield. You buy a buffer ETF, it has a target end value, a target protection layer. And I like your point that, the manager should look after the dynamics of that defined outcome all the way through, to make it a better product.
Yeah, it's just like what you're saying is it's fine, okay? Like to say I have this buffered ETF and this is exactly what it's due. My complaint is that they don't finish the sentence, right? The rest of the sentence is if I hold it to the end of the outcome period.
Yeah.
Right. And in the cases where they do finish the sentence, I don't think the advisor hears them. Right. Yeah. So again, like there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with models. You just have to understand what you're consuming. And like I tell you, half of my conversations are future proof is very clear evidence to me that a lot of folks don't.
Well, what you're saying is it's the equivalent of saying I can get 5% or close to 5% in a 30-year bond, right? But then
I've already given you my view on that comparison, yeah. Right? Yeah, I can give you the same yield at twice the risk. Let's go.
but you only get that 5% net over the entire duration if you hold it right to the end, right? Because of all the duration risk, but. No one is, few people are going to hold a 30-year bond to its maturity just to get the 5% that they can get, that they can get close to today. So that's the trade-off, right? Is that at any moment you might want to sell that 30-year bond that you're holding, which is yielding providing you with that yield to maturity that you paid for at five, just under 5%. And you assume all the risk. But the missing part of the end of that sentence is if you hold it to maturity.
Yes.
If you hold it right, like, and the same thing with the buffered products, structured notes, if you hold them right to the end.
Right. And if you can't look, you know, for an advisor whose average account size is $125,000, right? And he's got a very large number of accounts, right? He's got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of clients, you know, it's perfectly acceptable, right? I think that's an okay answer, right? But, right, like as we go up the ultra high net worth chain and those clients demand more sophistication and more risk control, right? And the advisor has to offer a more differentiated message in order to win their business in the first place. Then I think these kind of first generation products start to lose their appeal.
And you've talked about the first gen products, and we should expect this as you launch products that they do get better and better as they iterate. What's the and you talked about the behavioral bias that the experiential behavioral side of it too, where the advisor, like, it's not really what I thought it was. How does how you guys approach the problem help attenuate those behavioral biases, and what are the opportunities that it creates for you as you manage the portfolio?
Yes, so I think the onset, everything that we operate, both in our SMA side of the business and now in the ETF side of the house, we have very defined goals for what expectations are for portfolios and how we can be, you know, reasonably strong with those targeted goals is, again, we're risk managing the process continuously all the way through that experience. Now, with those stated goals, they might provide, you know, different opportunities to the end advisor, depending on what type of product we're talking about, right? And we, you know, operate multiple different things. I think a little bit of kind of what you're steering towards a little bit, Mike, is like our risk managed product, our product that's utilized to de-risk a portfolio in a positively convex way. Again, positive convex, we're hoping to make more money when the market's down than we lose on the way up. Positive convexity within the portfolio. And how we think about that is we're trying to improve day one experience from that asymmetry profile rather than something that's, you know, linear or defined. We're trying to provide rebalancing opportunities, and we're trying to improve tax efficiency of a portfolio. And, you know, as Devin kind of said, you know, 1.0 version versus next generation kind of 2.0 version of risk management for advisors, those are the kind of three bridges that we're trying to, you know, bring to advisors, allow them to cross with 2.0. And, you know, 1.0 version is bringing some asymmetry and not disrupting current portfolio holdings. Like if you're trying to get into a buffered product, well, the transaction has to take place. You have to get out of what you currently have into that product. And that may result in a tax outcome that's not beneficial, right? Like markets are at all-time highs. Doing that swish might have a tax friction. Doing things in an SMA might look to deliver a very similar risk adjustment, but doesn't have that day one tax friction. Rebalancing opportunities. If the market goes down significantly, your lower risk product that you have in the portfolio, maybe via, you know, a buffered style ETF, you have to make two decisions. You have to sell the thing that's down less to then buy the thing that's down more. Shift from a buffered ETF into SPY to do that rebalancing when the market's down. We've found from, you know, both experience and kind of natural behavior, that's tough to do, right? You know, everything's not going great and you have to make two decisions during that not great time. How we designed everything in doing in the SMA world is to have that be unencumbered cash directly in your client accounts. Meaning, if your client's at Schwab, the benefits of the hedge within the portfolio are just cash sitting in your Schwab account. So we like to say, rather than two decisions of having to sell the thing that's down less to, you know, buy the thing that's down more, it's actually zero decisions. You know, you're now out of home base. If your baseline exposure is 3% cash, market goes down, you might have 10% cash now sitting in that portfolio. that's actually now an active decision off of your model portfolio. It is a zero decision process to just get back to model. So, you know, outside of doing things in a way that doesn't create tax friction day one, we wanted to design everything that made the concept of rebalancing the markets down, you know, almost force, right? It is, you're off of home base if you don't do something, which then behaviorally, unsurprisingly, causes folks to actually do that rebalance even during chaotic events. And then the final piece, tax. You know, if you have something that's in a hedge equity product, that's a long short equity product, right? Long short equity products have gained a lot of proliferation over the last handful of years and a lot of adoption from the advisor community. And the reason is, hey, I'm targeting a specific amount of equity risk, but long short with that rebalancing that's taking place in those vehicles is creating distributable losses. Well, a hedged equity ETF is doing somewhat the same thing from a targeted risk perspective and a long and a short, but the fact that it's in an ETF wrapper never allows those losses to escape. You're essentially investing in a long short product, but in the wrong vehicle. It's in a vehicle that doesn't allow you to consume those losses, allow you to distribute those losses. And by splitting things up again into, you know, an SMA program where the long and the short are being rebalanced along that path, it's doing the same concept of a, you know, traditional long short direct indexing program. If now you have, you know, the risk that you wanted without disruption, a vehicle that allows you to somewhat auto rebalance during market sneezes, but then, you know, probably over the long term, most importantly, have distributable losses that you get to consume in the portfolio, either raising the cost basis of that portfolio or boxing out tax bills elsewhere in the portfolio. So, you know, again, 1.0, as kind of Devin alluded to, it has a place. It has a place in a lot of accounts. But having that same thought process of, I want long equity risk with a little bit of a short exposure, i.e. a little less than, you know, beta of one, there's a better way to do this in 2.0 for those right clients.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's akin to insurance on the insurance, right? I mean, you insurance on the structured outcome is what I mean. And you want to use some of the structured outcome to pay for that insurance to smooth the outcome. And I can't help thinking, you know, that like the job of the advisor is extremely complicated when you bring in, you know, the idea of the number of decisions they have to make, the behavioral risk, and then finally the tax risk. And the behavioral risk, this is the thing that always gets me. I think like people are so heavily concentrated on the subject of fees as a major source of friction. And it is, when you're putting a portfolio together at the outset, it's very nice to know, you know, you can buy a beta, you can buy an ETF for 3 beeps and get, you know, full exposure to whatever that index is. But the far bigger problem and the far greater cost that you're going to incur as an investor is from the potentially bad decisions that you make or the bad structures that you own. And I think that's your point. Your point is that when you're dealing with at 2.0, you're dealing with someone who has $100 million or $1 billion to allocate. They're not going to go for the first generation solution. They're going to want something that's structuring the structure.
Yeah.
On a structure, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the fee thing, price is what you pay, value is what you get. Right.
Right.
Like, just because things are inexpensive doesn't mean that they're good. Now, sadly, there's a lot of bad product out there. So filtering on price it ends up being the right thing for the wrong reason a lot. Okay.
Yeah.
A lot. But I would also say, just if, as long as we're talking about fees, I would say that, yeah, I liked what you said, and I just want to like amplify a little bit. You should think about fees for the amount of risk that you're getting, right? So you know, if you're paying just to make the numbers easy, 1% for a product that only delivers a beta of 1/2, that's like paying 2%, right, on the beta that, that you're actually getting. Okay. So
I love
this
it.
This isn't math, I think, that is obvious. Well, it's trivial math, but like, it's not obvious to people until you start adding derivatives into the mix, right? Like, if all we're going to do is count up the notional of a long only product, we never have to worry about this distinction. But in the, once we start like really adding derivative risk or targeting notional exposures different than 100, like you do need to think about what am I actually getting? Like when I buy any sort of investment or financial product, I'm getting an amount of risk, right? And that's what I should be paying. That's what should be levered to my fees, not the dollars that I gave you. That's the opportunity or the funding, right? Not the actual risk that's being consumed.
This happens a lot in our products, just because we offer derivative products on the future side, and that's about capital efficiency and the usage of capital. How much of that do you want to use? But if you want the product to run hot, let's say you wanted to run a 20 vol, well, that should be a higher fee because you just require less dollars to impart the same returns to the portfolio than you would if it were at a 10% vol. And so it's a bit of a complex conversation that is not well understood. On top of that, you can look at it from the standpoint of the entire portfolio's fee structure, right? So if I've got cheap and cheerful equity beta in my portfolio, 3 basis points, well, okay, when I'm adding these diversifiers and these alternative strategies, it's really the fee on top of the whole portfolio that you should be thinking about, not the fact that this thing has got a higher fee in and of itself. What's the prorated fee across the entire portfolio in order to get to the outcome that you want to achieve in the portfolio in its totality? It's another way to
what is what you're paying for actually worth?
How should advisors, allocators, and investors distinguish between, the strategies built around, more genuine structural mispricings, ones that have that extra layer of diligence, and how do they go through figuring that out?
So it's a really important question. I mean, you gotta get on the phone with the manager and you gotta ask them it's very simple. Where does the edge come from, right? Why is this better than just a cash investment, right? And the answer can't be, in the case of options, well, I'm giving you more exposure. I'm giving you leverage. I can borrow money and just go buy more stocks, right?
Yep.
So, the answer has to be whatever it is I'm buying. And this is, by the way, this is true of all investing, not just derivative strategies, right? Like we could make the same case for a commodity congestion strategy. Like it's universal. There has to be an edge that I believe that I'm accessing. Okay. Otherwise, you're simply, in the, to use the derivative world language, we would say that you're just buying payoffs, right? And if you buy payoffs long enough and cross the bid ask to do so, eventually you will just lose the difference between fair value and the bid ask. It's like gravity, okay? So that is an undeniable eventuality of buying payoffs. However, right, if the managers that you're hiring are harvesting an edge that they can articulate and justify and show to you, like, look, this is why we do what we do, because there's a bias here, or there's, like, whatever it is for your case, right? Now the fact that we're crossing the bid ask, right, is up for debate, okay? Like, yeah, I might be paying the offer, but if the offer was depressed to begin with, because there's, for example, in the derivative world, 110 billion of outcome products that are all looking to sell approximately the same calls and puts, right? Then, or because there's billions and billions, hundreds of billions of insurance product all pressuring roughly the same part of the S&P skew surface, right? Like, now it's like, okay, now we got something to work with, right? We're starting on the right side of the bias. So, the universal question is, what value is the manager adding? Like, what are they accessing that I can't do myself? And that's the first question. And if you can't get a good answer to that, then you should buy a cash product, right?
Interesting.
Absolutely. And now you've highlighted several ways in which you do that. Do you want to cover a couple more of those again here just to highlight some of the areas where that is specifically the case with Convexitas, whether it's in the ETFs or USMAs?
That's just how Zed spends all of his day every day. So I'll let him answer that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. I'll go with one that should feel familiar. Okay. So, there's these companies most likely headquartered in California that have created a lot of new, millionaires, decabillionaires, 100 millionaires from either being early investors, previous employees, current employees, and they're now all sitting happily worth $50 million, but 47 of that $50 million is in that company stock. And they want to start living the lifestyle of somebody with $50 million, but they really don't want to pay federal and an aggressive California state tax to access that liquidity to start living that lifestyle. So they all end up kind of doing something similar. And that's buy, put, sell, call, take a loan. It could be in a variable prepaid forward, can be just in your brokerage account. But ultimately, they're all kind of putting on a very similar trade. And once you put on that trade, you don't really get off that treadmill, right? Okay, I went ahead and bought my put, sold my call, took a $30 million loan against that $47 million of stock. But I spent, $25 of that buying my main house and my vacation house. So when the variable prepaid forward comes up to maturity, or the collar was 18 months, it's 18 months out, you say, do you want to pay back the money or do you want to do it again? Answer is, let's do it again. Let's extend the loan. That worked really well the first time. I spent the money. I don't have that liquidity on me. And you're telling me there's no issues to keep on doing it. So let's keep on doing it. So you have all these folks, they're in this situation. Once they get on the treadmill, they don't really get off the treadmill until they get to, get a step up in cost basis. And these types of products used to only be for, extremely, affluent folks. We're now, hey, if you're in this situation, but those numbers were $1 million, it's a point and click away at Schwab. Like, you could go on your Schwab account, say, contact trading desk, they'll recommend a collar to put on that stock. And they're like, oh, we'll connect you directly to Schwab Bank. You don't even need to borrow overnight from your brokerage account. We'll give you a term loan, right? So it's, been very much democratized. So you have something that, again, once you start, it's unlikely to stop until you get a step on cost basis. And the amount of folks that are able to participate are only increasing. So this is all, the things that are causing forced trading via folks that aren't necessarily talking about what's the fair price of that put. They're focused on an outcome, right? And even if they're overpaying, we'll call it fair value in terms of the options within this whole construct, it's probably still worth it. You could tell them dead to your face, you're leaking 2% per annum of value in this structure, but the, 35% they're avoiding and paying taxes, hey, that's just a cost of doing business. So even if it was laid out quite simply, how much you're leaking in terms of value, most of these folks would say, like, yeah, but it's still the right thing for me to do. So that's like a very blatant point of, this is what can create structural edge, right? You have all these folks that until, they get that step up a cost basis, frankly, upon death, they're probably 40, 50, 60 years old. They made a lot of money really fast, right? They're going to be doing this for a long period of time, are going to be forced put buyers in these names to secure that loan. And it's just distorting where they trade. And that's actionable value that we can, folks like us can extract in those situations. So, that's what we're looking for is we start from, hey, the price of these options is just persistently too high or persistently too cheap. Like, we're just looking at the prices, and you're like, it's just 9 out of 10 days, it's on one side of this. That's odd. Markets are efficient. So let's go investigate and figure out why we think there's flows that are causing this to happen. And once we've identified, okay, do we think this is where we're coming from? Like, then we're going to say, we think we have some actual structural edge here. And the next, like, final layer is like, why is somebody else not extracting this edge, right? And this specific example I went through is all the really smart volatility folks out there, the one thing they really hate is accepting idiosyncratic risk. Like, say you're working at a pod shop at, you know, Citadel, Optiver, Millennium. If you get a 3%+ drawdown, that's usually their trigger where they cut your capital in half from a risk manager. So you can set up all these, you know, great pairs trades, but if you're accepting a lot of idiosyncratic risk, that's the best way to derail yourself from a long-term career at one of these houses. So the edge could be significant, but you're like, that's not something that's in my, you know, toolkit of risk that I'm willing to take. So when we had this walkthrough again, we're like, okay, we saw prices that were persistently off. We came up with where we're pretty confident the source. And then the final leg, like, why isn't this extracted by others? Well, it's in that like category that, you know, there's not natural folks to take the other side of this. And then it was our job. Okay, we did our whole waterfall. We got to now productize this. We got to put this into something anybody would, you know, care about, and design the targets in terms of risk to be appropriate if we're in this hypothetical, like we're actually, not hypothetical, what we actually do, because we're accepting some of the idiosyncratic risk. We have to package it in a way that that's like a known quantity and part of, you know, the natural function of it. But that's what we mean by like just going through the whole waterfall of making sure you're on the right side of these positions in options trading.
Love it.
Fascinating.
Again, like we go back to my comments at the top of the recording here. Like the first question is how does this fit? What does it do for me? Right. And then the next question is how does it do those things? And is it sustainable? Right. Do I believe that that edge will persist? Right. And then do I believe the manager giving it to me can continue to deliver it? And if you can answer those questions, right, then I think you're good. Right. You don't, I for whatever reason, like, in the generation 1.0 derivative products, like we're very focused on telling people the payoffs, right? And like, you tell me the positions, right? Like we've even had advisors say, well, just tell me the positions and I'll understand the product. And we're like, I don't think so. So, you know, like it's a much different orientation, right? Like when you're using derivatives to make, you know, investment products rather than financial products, I would say. That's why we get paid a fee. So we do that professionally, right? You don't have to understand the detail all the way down to the brass, to the individual brass bolts, right? You have to understand what it's going to do for your portfolio, right? Plenty of people buy trend following strategies and they can't articulate the specific triggers of the trend strategies. Plenty of people buy, you know, this is an example from one of our investors. He says all the time, because people tell me I understand Microsoft stock, they can't tell me who the CFO is, right? So, you know, there's a difference between understanding what this thing does and what its role in your portfolio will be versus being a technical mastery of how it's a master of how it's implemented, right? Like I own lots of things in my personal account, particularly on the fixed income side, but I don't necessarily understand all of the covenants and the construction of the bonds in these portfolios. And I'm okay with it because I'm paying a fee to somebody that is supposed to be watching over it. And if I stop believing that they are, then we go find somebody else.
That's what specialization is all about. That's right. We all exist in our own silos of knowledge. So you've said, there's something I wanted to touch on because you've said roughly 2/3 of the long-term value of a risk mitigating strategy comes not from the protection itself, but from reinvestment, from having liquidity when everyone else is a forced seller.
Right.
If that's true from a portfolio construction point of view, how should advisors completely rethink what an options overlay is actually for? And what does a portfolio look like when it's built around that idea or that principle?
Right. So the idea here is that if you have a risk mitigating strategy that is profitable, it's negatively correlated, so it makes money when the market goes down, you should be able to access that value and you should be able to go do something with it. You should be able to take a withdrawal. You should be able to buy more stock, rebalance your portfolio back to your model, whatever do something means for you. Most often it means buy more stuff. Okay. Well, the issue with a lot of, if you're relying on a defined outcome product for this role in your portfolio, because the proceeds, are trapped in the fund or, you know, they're in the ETF, you are completely denied this opportunity, right? You can't take the proceeds of this put that they own and go and do something with it and buy more stuff, right? So if we really wanted to optimize for risk mitigation and squeeze all of the possible value out of a risk mitigating strategy, you really have to consume that in an SMA format rather than a fund format. And that doesn't have anything to do with the manager. It has to do with the reality of, if I want direct access to the proceeds and I want them to be reinvestable quickly, right? Because, the market's not going to wait 30 days for you,
right,
to rebalance, right? It may not even wait a week. These days, like this, you know, this past oil shock rally, you know, the fastest recovery on record from a shock. I mean, maybe we can define shock a couple different ways, but remarkably quickly, right? So you may not have enough time. So the point is, you really want to consume that strategy in the right format so that you have access to the proceeds to go do something with it. So then you can, then we also get in, you know, there's tax aspects of this as well. Zed talked about how, you know, risk mitigation strategies are essentially long short strategies. Right. They are convex long short strategies, which is different than tax aware long short equity, which is linear long short strategies. So, but the point is, you want to be able to access those tax benefits. You want to have the tax losses actually in your tax ID, in your account, so that you can net them against other things in your portfolio. These are unique demands of risk mitigation that are different than if we were constructing an income product. In the income product space, we're very happy for all these gains to be in the fund, right? Really short-term capital gains to be in the fund. In the risk mitigating case, we want the trades to be in our account. We want that SMA delivery so that we can take the proceeds, we can rebalance, we get the tax benefits that come along with the tax lots from the short side, and we can rebalance all of these things together at the same time. But, you know, back to your original point, you know, our estimation is if the direct proceeds of our risk mitigating strategy only account for about a third of the long-term compounding. It's taking that and then going and buying more stuff, or you're rebalancing, or kind of, you know, how, whatever that means for you, that might, you know, that might create as much as twice the value of our direct proceeds. So to give that up is to give up, in our opinion, a very significant benefit of a risk mitigation strategy. Like you want to be able to use the proceeds, not just, I mean, it's great. Like when the market goes down and the ETF doesn't go down as much, great. Like that's good on the day. But wouldn't it be better if you took the proceeds that generated that difference and went and reinvested it? Be a lot better, right? Well, you could do that in the SMA wrapper, whereas you can't. So, you know, as a caveat, again, back to this account size thing, like, is this something that the advisor can take on for every $100,000 account? No, of course not, right? Like to be at this kind of Cadillac level of optimization, like we're talking about doing this for bigger accounts, right? Where you need this level of reinvestment and tax awareness, and where it's going to serve the advisor as a differentiated offering, right? So it doesn't, you know, this doesn't scale for the advisor to thousands of accounts. right. that are lower in size, right? This is more of an ultra high net worth, more of an ultra high net worth style of thinking. But again, we think it's a mistake to take, you know, the very straightforward Buffett style product and offer that up as your risk mitigation solution to a guy with $20 million. Like, you can do better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two things come to mind on that for me. One is structure often dictates strategy. So you have to think through the structure of what you're offering a strategy through, because it will have limitations that you may or may not like or be acceptable to you when you're thinking through the structuring of a product. So that's something very important to think through. Size has to do with that. And the other thing is, you know, you hear all the time the old Buffett adage of buy when there's blood in the streets. And I don't know how that works when you're supposed to be fully invested all the time. And so having some risk mitigating strategies in your portfolio, the intent of which is to have them provide returns that are non-correlated coming in a different time, negatively correlated in some cases, so that you actually have capital to deploy during those times of duress.
Right, but it needs to, but critically, it has to be accessible capital. You have to actually be able to take the proceeds and do something with it, which right. If those gains are trapped in a 40 Act fund or a tail risk hedge fund or something like that, you may not, you know, one of two things has to happen. You're either going to face a redemption window in the case of the hedge fund to get the capital back, and those are not going to be quick, right? Or it's now on the advisor to sell the defined outcome ETF and replace it with something else, which has its own cadre of tax problems, right? So, you know, the whole point here is you're dead right, but it's got to be accessible. I've actually got to be able to get my hands on it.
Precisely.
If you structure it right, then, you know, you've got a portfolio that actually gives you liquidity when you need it the most and when it's most opportune.
Okay.
Right. I mean, when you see these recoveries like we did a few weeks ago, where, you know, the S&P gaps up and closes at a record on that Friday, you know, people look at that and they think, well, who was in there? Right. And it's almost always, to a large degree, it's short covering, right? That drove that initial bounce off the bottom. And then it's followed by maybe some, you know, dip buying. But how much of that is actually someone deciding I'm gonna jump back in the market at this low? And it's either somebody who has the cash to do it, which is to your point, or it's somebody who has an absolute need to cover a short position, which drives that initial V-shape recovery. But what you're talking about is being on the side of someone who has liquidity at the most opportune moment to buy when there's blood in the street. Yeah.
But the biggest benefit of a risk mitigation strategy should be that it's giving you fresh capital
right
when things are on sale. That should be the biggest benefit. The mark-to-market benefit should be the second benefit, although that's often treated as the first.
It's funny though, right? When you know, you read these quotes, these adages from Warren Buffett, from John Templeton, you know, it makes all the sense in the world when you're reading it. It's a, you know, they're beautiful, eloquent quotes. But the reality is that, you know, if you're an investor with 90% equity risk and the market draws down sharply against you, chances are, unless you've got 15 or, you know, 10 or 15 or 20% cash in your portfolio, you don't, you know, you're going to need that cash. You're not going to want to deploy it. Right. And secondly, typically retail investors aren't lining up to buy the stock market when it's down 20, 30, 40%. They're usually fleeing.
They're buying more hair.
You're making a beautiful case for unfunded overlays. Yes.
Yeah. gentlemen, I think, you know, we have, tested the limits of your time today. I think, you know, it's been a terrific conversation. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
Yeah, happy to chat. It's, you know, I think Zed and I view a large part of what we do is education and trying to evangelize, you know, what the next version of derivative use can look like in wealth. And, you know, we're always really excited to do that.
I think it would be, it would be terrific if we could, you know, if we could codify a way to, for more folks, for more investors to be able to do the things that, that Warren Buffett has so quietly done so well over the years.
Well, but Return Stacked is doing that. I mean, I'm just going to say, like, Return Stacked did it. What is, go read that very famous paper, Warren Buffett's Alpha. Okay. It's a beautiful paper. Yeah. What does it come down to? It comes down to leveraged factor investing. That paper explains nearly all, you know, statistically all of his returns with FAMA French factors and leverage. Okay. Now, not to take it away from him. I mean, he did it at a time when we didn't have statistics and before these factors existed. And I'm like, you know, he figured it out himself, right? Intuitively. That's a big deal. So bless him. He's great. But this is exactly what return stack products do, right? Is harness these things, right? And actually can also give you the leverage, you know, the reasonably priced leverage, right? Not, you know, margin leverage is not useful with 12%, right? But reasonably priced leverage to give you those things. So, you know, it's a great example of, you know, the Buffett example actually is attainable now with things that are available.
It's incredible when you stop and think about, you know, how logistically challenging it is to be able to actually act on that impulse, to actually do those things. Unless you're the guy who's just about to invest and the market crashes, wonderful, right? That you're the investor exactly, right? So either it's a behavioral constraint or you know, like investors always get hamstrung one way or another. That's what makes it so challenging and difficult at times.
I mean, this should be the value of your advisor. The guys should have a plan and should be helping you impose this discipline. It's a big part of what a good advisor I think should be doing.
What do you think is the biggest surprise 12 months from now?
I'll answer, but I'm going to say this is kind of not what we do. like our products and the things that we create are meant to, you know, harness biases and then deliver a profile, right? So that's a little bit very rarely, do mine or Zed's, you know, personal investment thesis have a big impact on what we're doing. You know, we are structural investors, not macro investors. You know, but that said, you know, I'm always up for some guesses. I think that there ends up being more inflation and fiscal stress than people think there's going to be. And I think that oil ends up being a far, far less of an issue than we think it is today.
All right.
I'll go really boring by saying it's incredibly binary and extreme in each case. I think we have a heavily financialized economy, whether it's indebted governments, whether it's corporates. I mean, heck, you saw whatever last week Meta raised $86 billion to continue to keep building out data center, which is, you know, much of the growth in R&D that's going on. And I think you have consumers very much supporting lifestyle from return and asset prices. So I think they're all heavily connected. So as long as credit markets remain open and rates can hang on here, I think, you know, growth can actually like accelerate as financialization just continues to push things, you know, upwards and onwards. But if there's any sand in the gears from either higher rates or credit markets seizing up, I think the left tail is sadly a lot worse than you normally think in that situation.
Those are, you know, great contrarian views, because a lot of the consensus is the opposite. So what a terrific conversation, honestly. Like, I think that there's so much in there. There's so much food for thought in there for advisors and investors to sort of get a much better grasp or understanding of why it is that, you know, how their portfolio could be better structured in order to do some of those things, in order to capture those moments where, you know, they could actually act on the bargain hunting when the market's on sale.
Yes, I agree.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you. Thanks, Devin. Thanks, Ed. Great having you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Pierre, Mike.